All right. Well, good morning, everyone, and good afternoon for those of you who are in Europe today, or evening perhaps if you're a little further afield in Asia. My name is Daniele Giovannucci. I serve as president of the Committee on Sustainability Assessment, and we are co-hosting this webinar today along with the Conexus Corporation. Briefly, COSA is a nonprofit institution. Our objective is to advance pragmatic global measurement tools to understand, to better manage, and ultimately to accelerate sustainability in agriculture. Our work essentially refines sustainability knowledge and shares tools, including this kind of process in a webinar with two brilliant people, to help empower smarter strategic, smarter management, in essence, for companies, for institutions, and ultimately, of course, for producers themselves. And our focus is on developing countries. COSA and Conexus are hosting this 60-minute webinar. It'll be 1 hour, and we'll be recording it for those who would like to hear it later on. And we're doing it to challenge some of the common assumptions on a handful of topics regarding the scaling of technology and innovation in agriculture, improving food security via market mechanisms, and particularly facilitating the appropriate links for responsible supply chains. One key focus of many of these issues, certainly today in 1 hour of a sort of master class here, if you will, is going to be the major shifts that are occurring in rural urban food supply chains, particularly in developing countries. Information that Tom has shared with us, and you'll hear much more from him in a moment, is surprising. It certainly would surprise many of us that in just a few decades, these domestic rural urban supply chains have grown dramatically, as much as 800% in countries in Africa on average, and even more in Southeast Asia. So we have two great experts with us today. They're going to offer a stimulating hour challenging the assumptions on these topics, and most of all, I think, offering us some pragmatic insights and advice for developing folks who are working on development issues, for policymakers, and also, of course, for enterprise. We're going to offer each of them 6 to 8 minutes. They'll share some insights with us, and then we're going to invite questions and discussions from listeners. Let me ask you to submit those now, if you like, or during the session using the chat function that you'll see on the right-hand side of your screen. So, without further ado, let me introduce our two speakers for today. The first of these is our partner in this process, Anita Campion, and she serves as president and CEO of Conexus. Anita is a seasoned economist with more than 2 decades of experience, especially in finance and in private sector development. She's widely acknowledged as a rural agricultural finance expert, and she's authored several very, very useful products, including a primer on the topic for USAID, the United States Agency for International Development. She's also served as executive director of the Microfinance Network, where she grew it into a leading policy institution that develops and promotes microfinance best practices. Anita's also managed challenging projects in other many diverse parts of the world, youth and enterprise development in the DRC. She's helped launch the UNCDF's Youth Start program. And in years past, Anita's also managed the financial sector portfolio for Chemonix International and has overseen projects around the world. So we'll hear from her in just a moment. Tom Reardon is a tenured professor at MSU, where he's earned the Distinguished Faculty Award, and I know he's transformed a generation of young scholar activists with his passion, his insight, and his humor. I've been the happy recipient of his wisdom over the years. And in those 34 years, I think one of the most amazing things about Tom, perhaps what adds wisdom, not just knowledge, to his portfolio, is that he spent 21 of those years directly in the field. So it isn't from the ivory tower at all. Tom knows a lot of things, but one of the particular focal areas, especially for today, is the transformation of our agri-food systems and the implications of that for small farmers and small agro-industrial organizations and enterprises. His focus has also encompassed the nature of the links with urbanization, food security, and globalization. Tom's scientific work is among the world's most cited, particularly in areas such as modern food markets, development, and small farmers. He's appeared in many publications. He edits and authors more than most people, and they've included not just the academic world, but also things like the front page of the New York Times and NPR, which is National Public Radio here in the U.S. He's been honored as a fellow of the Agriculture and Applied Economics Association. He appears in countless high-level fora, from the World Economic Forum to the Chicago Council of Economic Affairs, and of course on this high-level forum of the COSA Connexus webinar series. So we're really happy to have Tom with us today. Briefly, one small note for those of you who are attending or who plan to attend or would like to attend the Cracking the Nut Conference that in 2017 this year will take place in Bangkok at the end of March on the 27th and 28th. This is, of course, managed and put out by Connexus, and it's going to focus on reinforcing food systems to meet urban demand, and you'll hear why that's important in the coming hour. Its purpose is to raise awareness of the challenging demographics that are shifting, and also the changing food preferences that are impacting global supply and demand for food. That event is going to highlight how food systems are transforming to meet this shift. And the key transformation is the shifting nature of rural to urban markets and the increased need for linking them in a responsible way, right? Thinking about that as we consider these new conditions in the world of development. So for more information on that, you can visit the Connexus website or crackingthenutconference.com. I love that title. I want to just keep repeating it. So you can visit their website, crackingthenutconference.com. Or if you arrived here through COSA, please feel free to write us, and we'll forward your communication promptly. So without further ado, we're going to start with Tom, I believe, today. And so, Tom, let me turn the microphone over to you, and we'll get started.
Thank you very much, Daniele. This is really great to be on this webinar this morning and to join Anita in this. I wanted to make in my a few introductory minutes about just six quick points. The first point is that Daniele had mentioned that we're really focusing a lot on the domestic market, and I think that's worth emphasizing that really the market for food for farmers in developing countries is really overwhelmingly domestic. Overall, in terms of the food consumption in developing countries, about 90% comes from domestic supply chains. And probably 95% of farm output goes to the domestic market rather than exports. And about only 10% on average of food is in fact imported. And some of our work shows that imported share is due to decline over time as incomes rise. Sort of a surprise conclusion. So the first key point is, while export markets can be quite exciting and at the margin can be very important for farmers and for certain crops, of course, like coffee, overwhelmingly the important market is the domestic market. So how to crack the nut and get small farmers selling to that domestic market is the crucial question. The second point is that, let's say 20 years ago, that market would be considered to be overwhelmingly a rural market, with the urban market just a minor sideshow. But in fact today, the urban market is by far the dominant market as well as consumption share of food in developing regions, both Africa and Asia and Latin America. Even in the poorest place in the world, which is the eastern and southern Africa outside of South Africa, The urban market already forms 40% of food consumption and 50% of the food market. In a decade, that'll be something like two-thirds of the market will be basically urban. Okay. West Africa, just like Southeast Asia, interestingly, the numbers are very similar in both of those regions. The share of the urban market is already about 55% of consumption and 70% of the market. So when you're talking about reaching the market in this discussion, you're talking mainly about how to reach the urban markets of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And those urban markets are not just giant mega cities. In fact, 60% of the urban population is in secondary cities and tertiary cities and rural towns. This is really a vibrant, important sector and is closer to rural areas, so tends to be more accessible. The third point I want to just reemphasize, the wonderful point that Daniele made at the beginning, which is that these supply chains of food are like rivers running, these giant rivers running from rural areas to urban areas. And in volume, for example, in Africa, in just a couple decades, the volume of that river has increased 800%. So you just think of a business growing 800% in a couple decades. This is a gigantic volume of increase. And in Southeast Asia, that number is 1,000%. So this has been really the main growth area has been in the rise of the urban market for rural people in those two regions, and also in Latin America. The fourth point is that the nature of that market has changed. In some of my work, I've emphasized that there's been a very rapid rise of supermarkets. So the way people are shopping in urban areas has changed rapidly and will continue to change. It happened earlier in Latin America and Asia, and now it's happening in Africa. Another angle of change in the market is that a lot of people tend to think that the people mainly eat grains. But in fact, even in the poorest part of Africa and in the rural part of that, only 50 to 65% of the diet is in grains. And the other two-thirds to a half, a third to a half of the diet is in things like fruits and vegetables, meat and fish, dairy, very important. And in rural Asia and urban Africa, already about two-thirds to 70% of diets are now in those non-grain products. So this is really where the action is in this fruits and vegetables, meat and fish, dairy, and oil seeds. And they rock it up, and grain demand is relatively stable. There's also a rapid rocketing up of processed food consumption, which is now about half to two-thirds of consumption in the two areas, including in rural areas. My fifth point is that we've also tended to look in the past at rural areas as being just, let's say, farmers growing what they eat and eating what they grow. That's the old view. But in fact, what we find now, even in Eastern and Southern Africa, that about 50% of the diet in value terms is purchased. And in areas like West Africa and Southeast Asia, and in the, even South Asia, about 60 to 80% of the diet is purchased. This means that people are paying for this with crop sales and rural non-farm employment especially. And that means that there's a big rural market that's growing quickly. Okay, and so they're farm households and rural households are exposed to the market and running at the market as buyers and also as sellers. My final point is that these things, this very rapid urbanization of the market, the change of the composition in terms of products, diversifying the products of the market, and also, in a sense, the commercialization of the market of the rural areas with the rocketing up of rural purchases, all that emphasizes that the debate about competitiveness, which used to be something really as a that was really a marginal debate on the side focused on agribusiness for maybe exports. Now competitiveness is a mainstream topic. Okay, how to dovetail the competitive debate with the rural development, and that farmers are in a market crucible, not in a hinterland market vacuum anymore. So this is, I think, the main points that I wanted to make to start out. Thank you very much.
Tom, thank you very much. That was fascinating, and a tour de force of the dramatic changes that I think upend a lot of the assumptions that many of us make or have made for decades. And I know that the teaching that's going on in many universities around these topics and other parts of the world within development agencies is often mired still in a previous view, in an older view, without the benefit of these most recent developments. And I think it's fascinating to start being aware of them, because we're otherwise preparing people for the past instead of helping them prepare for the future and for future work. So thank you very much for that. Let's talk about another side of this piece, which is critical to the issues that Tom is talking about, the lubricant, if you will, that enables everything else to move forward and to work, and that is the issues of finance, right? The factor of finance. Without that, and having it readily available, all of this kind of work gets mired in either as charity or as something that moves forward very, very slowly. And so how do we deal with finance in that area? And Anita's an expert in that realm. Let's hear what she has to say. Anita?
You okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Sorry. Yeah, I had some technical difficulties, but luckily I'm familiar with Tom's work. And thank you, Tom and Danielle. And just wanted to give you a little bit of background on the access to finance piece. What we have seen is consistently the lack of access to finance. It continues to be one of the most significant barriers to rural and agricultural development. And so ultimately, it's an important factor for food security. The whole concept of the Cracking the Nut conference initially started in 2011, when we realized that there were a lot of new efforts going on to understand what was needed in rural and agricultural development and the access to finance. And there are a lot of new people entering, and I was very nervous that we were going to have to relearn some of the lessons we'd already learned in the 1970s. So I wanted to kind of make sure that we were clear on that. So some of the things that we had been tried in those early days was a lot of, you know, subsidies to farmers, credit guarantees at different levels, 50% up to 80% of the loan being guaranteed, sometimes up to 100%, and then, of course, there's no not enough incentive for the bank to actually collect on that loan. And then we had the entrance of a number of public development finance institutions, or ag banks. And there were a number of things that were attempted that didn't exactly get us what we were hoping for. Instead, what we often got were some cheap funds. The subsidized funding often went to other sectors or to the not the ones that most needed it. We saw repayment problems, as it was kind of communicated that agriculture was not a serious business, and we really kind of scared off the private sector in many ways from providing agricultural finance because it was seen to be kind of too risky. So what we've been doing since 2011, we really wanted to highlight what some of these new approaches were that were working and make sure that we didn't make some of the mistakes that we'd made in the past. And so what was new in 2011 was that there was a lot more going on related to agricultural value chains, and different from what we previously called subsector development, the focus was really on having a clear connection to an end market and how important that was in facilitating finance. So in 2011, we documented a number of these approaches. The need to really understand the agribusiness model and the crop cycles, and that financial products had to be adopted accordingly. And you know, what that meant, oftentimes there needed to be a grace period, and then the collection needed to happen right upon harvest time. Large agricultural value chain actors were seen as very important. We were seeing ways that they could actually help to facilitate the flow of finance to smallholders. And smallholders in general have always had the most difficulty in accessing finance. So by linking to folks like processors and aggregators and wholesalers that had an interest in making sure the smallholders had the access to finance so that they could provide adequate supply and the right quality of supply of production, they were actually helping to turn on the access to finance. And we saw a number of microfinance institutions with a social mission. Previously, they'd been kind of told stay away from agriculture. They were now starting to explore lending, especially small loans to farmers. But they were often doing it based on multiple sources of income, so rather than just the agricultural income alone. And in some countries, we saw banks would actually lend for agriculture, but most of those loans were going to the large agribusinesses and were based on fully collateralized loans. So, often 100 to 200% of the loan value provided in cash or hard collateral. And we saw there was a growing recognition that cash flow-based lending was a better approach for small and medium enterprises, what we called the missing middle, who often couldn't meet the bank's collateral requirements. And so we started seeing some of those cash flow-based lending approaches being applied for agribusiness as well. So since then, what we've seen is a significant increase in impact investors using creative ways to facilitate rural and agricultural finance. And they often build on the buy-sell contracts. The export function, as it was talked about, was an easier way because it linked to the hard currencies, but also using the relationships of trust within value chains to reinforce the on-time repayment. We also saw microfinance institutions doing more upscaling, so they would offer larger loans that had to do with agribusiness, and banks doing more downscaling, reaching more the small and medium enterprises using the cash flow-based lending approach on both of them. And then also we saw what we call internal value chain finance, and that's basically where one of those processors or wholesalers that is important to the strength of the food chain as a whole would actually help to facilitate. Sometimes they gave loans directly to smallholders themselves to make sure they met their quality standards. And once that cycle had been demonstrated to be successful, financial institutions were seeing that and saying, okay, we can provide that finance directly if you provide a partial guarantee or you make sure that the loan is paid off before you pay the producer for their supply. So most recently, kind of what we've been learning, and each year with the cracking the nut, what we're attempting to do is look at the issue with a different lens. So we started with the finance lens, but then we realized that we really needed to make sure we fully understood agricultural markets. And we needed to look at what are the realities and the impacts of climate change. And we've slowly been kind of looking at different perspectives. And so this year we're really looking at that, the links between the rural supply chains and the urban market demand. And so I think that a lot of the points that Tom brought up were very, very relevant. What we've seen in some of our work, and Connexus does work on several large projects around the world, often USAID-funded. We've been working in Ghana on the USAID-funded FinGap project, and what we've seen there is that there's a disconnect between how the financial institutions view risk and how the agribusinesses view risk. So what we've tried to do is bring the business advisory service providers in with the financial institution representatives to train them so that they get to know each other even better and they learn more about how financial institutions perceive risk and what types of information they need to overcome their concern for lending to a certain sector. And one thing that we found is that by helping them to see that there are certain market opportunities within a value chain, and if those weaker points can be addressed, then there's an even bigger opportunity to help facilitate the flow of finance to the value chain as a whole. And so through that project, we've helped to facilitate more than $110 million in access to finance and investment for the rice, maize, and soy value chains alone, which has been the focus of that project. And we really were able to do that partly because we integrated into all the training materials and the market information that had to do with what these market opportunities were, as well as how to manage the risks associated with those markets. And financial institutions saw that by really kind of making a commitment to a sector as a whole, they could build up their portfolio in this area as a whole as well. Do you want me to stop there? Do you want me to talk a little bit? I guess maybe that's probably a good place to stop.
That's a wonderful start, Anita. We'll certainly have more opportunities to dig into this just a little bit. We've got a number of questions coming in from folks in different fronts, and we encourage you to continue sending those questions. We have now, we're just about ready to jump into the discussion part. That's the juicy part where we get to address your questions and grapple with some of the thorny issues given the context. My side of this, I'll keep brief so that we have more time for that. From my perspective, and it's based on, unfortunately, a few decades of not the most positive experience with agribusiness or agro-enterprise development in many of the countries we're talking about. And I think if I had to distill the challenges down to one particular topic, it has something to do, or at the core of a lot of this, is inadequate information. And I don't mean just information in the sense of data, because we have certainly enough, maybe too much data in some cases. It's about knowledge or distilled information. I think Anita made that case quite well when she said that that lenders and financial institutions go in often not understanding the local context and may upend the nascent or fragile financing systems that already exist, or in cases where they don't understand what kind of financing is needed and the level of risk. They may underestimate or overestimate different pieces of it, and that's, I think, been a traditional problem in the area of financing. Tom's point, I think, also has a common thread that runs through it, is our inability to gauge these shifts over the last couple of decades, sea change shifts in many senses that really alter the way we should be looking at development in rural space. And yet, as I look at the agendas and the syllabuses of most of the trainings that are happening for young economists and young development actors in the field, you know, we're still operating in a model that is mired in the 80s in many cases. And as I can do by my sophisticated mathematical capabilities, that was a long time ago. So for me, the issue really does often comes down to that the interventions that we undertake in development rarely are based on sound analysis and not just external analysis, but the need to collaborate with local actors. I've often heard that, well, they just don't understand, or they're illiterate. Well, they're often smarter than we are, and we have to get past whatever level of literacy there is, because local people know what's necessary quite often, and it's in that collaborative space that we begin to understand how to act or how to move most effectively. And frankly, I think I'm willing to bet that Tom and Anita would share that one of the common lessons through all of this is a bit of humility going into rural space. The second topic related to this, of the three topics I would mention, has to do with the fact that we still continue, and in some cases have reverted to measuring inputs or activities rather than outcomes or impacts. And while that was certainly the vogue for many years when we didn't have sophisticated instruments up to, I'd say, the 80s or early 90s, that certainly has changed. Our ability to understand impact is enormous now. It's improved considerably. and the fact that we still have tons of projects that measure their success based on how many farmers they trained or how many tons of new exports exist or similar factors, I think is really is woeful, and I think represents one of the major stumbling blocks of determining what are really best practices and how can we scale up what's working, because we keep doing the same thing again and again and again. We recently had a very depressing outcome and it's not the only one, but it's one that comes to mind in a particular supply chain, relatively well managed, where training was the issue, and the entity or the large global actor that was managing the supply chain had spent several million dollars on improving training for farmers in this region, which of course is a very typical intervention, arguably the most typical. And at the end of the process, we understood after 3 years using a complete set of impact assessment metrics, including control groups, that the level of adoption by farmers of the training, much less the impact of the results we're looking for, was very, very, very low, almost nil. And that points to not the fact that the training was bad, because we checked and it was conducted by very competent, very capable institutions, seven of them in a country, five of them international agencies. And so the training we know was good, was high quality. And yet the farmers' willingness to adopt, to change, to address the potential, the needed change to have impact or to have a result, just was not evident. And so understanding that issue of adoption, I think, becomes key. And then finally, this idea of, that we wait a little too late. Even impact assessment can take a couple of years to really see change. And failing to adequately monitor supply chain performance or even rural performance or project performance is absolutely unconscionable today. Technology exists. Good indicators exist. All of this is out there at extremely low cost and essentially represents the basic principles of HACCP, of hazard analysis at critical control points, or of any manufacturing process, that you'd want to see things as they're progressing. You want to see if you are on a viable impact pathway, or if what you're doing really is likely to not be useful long before the project closes. So our ability to engage technology and to use many new tools, there are a handful. We at COSA work with a number of corporations who are now doing this, so it isn't conceptual. This is actually very tangible. And these are the kinds of things that are widely available globally. So we can improve things like technical efficiency in the field, improve targeting of farmers, improve the delivery of services, the delivery of financing, through much more effective communication and data flow today than we ever have before. And these are just simple business tools, so this isn't rocket science, but yet we don't use them in the service of producers, farmers, and rural communities as we should. So those are my quick comments on some of the themes that I think underlie a lot of the issues we've been discussing and represent perhaps one of the ways forward. But we have lots of questions. So let's stop there with our inputs from our side, and please let's open this up to some of the questions that we have. And let's start with the first one for Tom, that one of the attendees asks, given the huge shifts that are taking place, the shifts in consumption toward more fruit, vegetables, meat, and dairy, what are the implications for environmental sustainability? What shifts in agriculture practice are needed to ensure that future agriculture is environmentally sustainable? And what are the implications for policymakers? What are the shifts and what are the implications for policymakers in these shifts of production? Tom, would you like to take that on?
Yes, thank you. This is a very exciting question. And I have a few points. And it'll seem like I'm starting in a sense, indirectly, but I'll get to the sustainability impacts point. I think I want to dovetail with something that Anita said, it's really about the fact that farmers in Asia and in Africa really don't have access to bank loans. And really, we've also found that by and large, they actually don't have much access to informal lending. It's very minor and often and almost never used for agricultural purposes. And the microfinance, I think, also tends to cover a very small number of farmers. So really, what farmers are relying on for cash for both their diet needs and in our recent data work we found for their purchase of inputs is almost all from crop sales and rural non-farm employment, not even migration employment. Migration is very, very minor as a share of income. It's basically rural non-farm employment. And so with those sources of cash, that's what they can use to finance things like soil conservation investments and fertilizer and manure, et cetera. So it's very important to think about the link between productivity, sustainability, and commercialization of agriculture as a way to generate the cash. And the second point is that in our data work in Africa and Asia, we found that farmers really, except outside of projects where an NGO or a government comes in and works with the farmers and sets things up, farmers tend to make investments in soil conservation, such as tide ridges and bunding and terraces, where they're producing cash crops. And I mean by cash crops not, just something like soybean or something like that. I mean all of these sorts of products that we're talking about, fruit and vegetables and dairy and meat and fish and the commercializable forms of the grains, etc. So when they're making money, that's when they tend to do these conservation investments on their own with their own money. And the same thing with purchase of fertilizer and manure and irrigation to intensify production. And I was amazed by that because our data show that there's outside of projects, which are kind of artificial environments, in general, farmers are only making these sustainability and productivity investments where it pays, and where it pays is where they can sell the crops. And I asked a Rwandan farmer about this result, and he said, "We put money on money," which I thought was the most wonderful short statement I've ever heard, because they're not putting their effort into conservation investments or productivity investments for their products that they're not selling or that are just subsistence crops. So this is very important. The third point is that a lot of this intensification and shift of composition reduces pressure on the commons. So people can intensify their production rather than extensifying out into the forest margins and the bush margins. So that, in a sense, leads to more sustainability. So I'm drawing a line between commercialization and intensification of production and sustainability, both through investments by farmers and soil conservation investment and less pressure on the commons. But I think finally, it makes sense. In my initial remarks, I was emphasizing that competitiveness is really what the small farmer has to focus on, and that can really dovetail with sustainability. For example, investing in drip irrigation, which saves water, laser leveling, GIS, precision farming, etc., are good for both competitiveness and for sustainability of crop production. Thank you.
Great, Tom. Very good reply to that. There are a number of questions floating in. Here's one for Anita that I know has been a hot topic over the last few years. Is there any evidence that weather or crop-related insurance is effective as a financial product in your experience? And obviously, I think the writer is asking for that among smallholders, small and medium enterprises in developing countries.
Sure. No, I think that there's a number of advantages that the weather index or index-based insurance offers, you know, over crop insurance. Traditional crop insurance had a number of issues to do with moral hazard, and it was, in general, it continues to be very expensive, and so farmers have a hard time actually affording to pay for crop insurance. Whereas index-based insurance is set up so that you can pretty simply determine whether or not there's likely a loss, and then payment is based on just something, you know, the measurement of that weather. So it might be, you know, excessive rain, or it might be drought, you know, kind of monitoring how much rain there's been in a certain area. What I have found is that it's particularly helpful to reducing risk for a financial institution that has a portfolio invested in agriculture. And it's still a little bit tricky to sell the insurance on an individual basis to farmers, but we're getting there. And so as we've gotten more experience with using the agricultural insurance models, then the farmers are more likely to see the value in investing them on their own. The one downside of the index-based insurance is that it doesn't perfectly cover those with a loss. Sometimes it will cover folks that didn't have a loss, and sometimes it won't cover somebody who did have a loss. But it's much cheaper because you don't have to send somebody out there to actually check out what happened on the farm, and that's where the cost of the crop insurance got quite expensive. So I think we will continue to see the use of index-based insurance. And but I think it's going to happen more at the wider portfolio level before getting down to the individual borrower as much. The other issue we're still working on with this one is a lot of the countries we work in are fairly small. So Rwanda, for example, we're looking at ways to use index-based insurance there. But the trick is to be able to then sell that portfolio of insurance to reinsurance companies such as Swiss Re, and where they can actually then, so that not all the risk that's inherent in Rwanda stays in Rwanda, so it kind of goes to a global level. And World Bank has been very actively involved in trying to develop the global reinsurance markets for these agricultural insurance type products.
Excellent. Thank you, Anita. You know, I'm getting some of these great questions about can we talk about the future of small farming in developing countries and the lack of scale, which I think is fascinating and probably could be an entire, not just a webinar, probably a month online to hear the opinions on that topic. So if anyone wants to take it on, you're more than welcome in your answer. But let me get to something also just a tad more specific. Tom was mentioning the consumption of non-grain products is increasing. The attendee asks, what are some of the main opportunities to support the development of this sector in developing countries? Tom?
Or yes.
Anita? Yeah.
So, am I unmuted?
You are.
Hello? Okay. So the question is about how to support the non-grain products?
That's right. Given that they're increasing, and if I could combine several questions having to do with both environmental issues, food security issues, and general opportunities for development in the non-grain products area.
Okay, food security, what else?
Environment.
Okay.
And in general opportunities, which I'll read to be economic.
Okay, I think that, I mean, this is a fascinating question because I think that there's so many areas that need attention in support of small farmers and other rural enterprises that are dealing with this. And I want to emphasize the rural enterprises as well, because there's really a lot of off-farm components of the food system that are working in the area of handling, processing, wholesaling, warehousing, transporting, that need a lot of attention and support. And really, they're maybe 50, 60, 70% of the economy of these non-grain products is tied up in these off-farm services. And it's not just off-farm services that are after the farm gate. There's a lot of importance of mechanization and irrigation support and services and sales and, you know, let's say veterinary services. Feed supply chains are extremely important for the meat and the poultry and the fish, so that the package of activities that go from upstream in services and inputs to farm level to midstream in terms of handling and processing and packing the product and selling it, all these things are opportunities for income generation, employment generation of women and men within these areas, and also are important to be able to grow that sector, okay, all of those. The second general point to make, beside the fact that there's this whole supply chain to think about, the second point is that all of those aspects, as well as the cropping itself or the production of these products, is very, very often ignored by the regular extension system. Okay, they basically, if you're producing anything but, let's say, rice in Asia and a few grains in Africa, maybe maize, you're off the radar screen. And so you're not getting information about disease treatment and feed ratios and irrigation and greenhouses and handling of these products. So I think there's an enormous need for that, both directly from services as well as linking with nascent services that are being provided by the private sector in those domains. Let me stop there. I might have not answered enough, but I also don't want to hog the podium.
No, that's great, Tom. Very insightful, and I think that we can pick up some of those threads going forward. Today, obviously, on these calls, the ability to answer everything in depth is constrained, and so hopefully folks understand that. We will be saving your questions, particularly if you've identified yourself in the questions, and I think we have so many now that please do include your email address, and we'll pass them along to the appropriate person and try to get them all answered, because they obviously won't all get answered online. But here's one that I think is particularly fascinating, and it certainly reflects our own perspective at COSA in terms of our global work, that perhaps among the most effective interventions, or ineffective if they don't work, for small farmers is the presence of cooperatives and small rural enterprises that agglomerate either demand or supply, and that permit markets to flow. So the question here, and we find it fascinating, I'll just as an aside, in part because with several of our partners, notably the FAO and EFAD and others, we gathered 30 institutions to develop metrics or a metric system to understand cooperative effectiveness and efficiency, and that's going to be available freely online over the next in about 2 or 3 months, so that people will have that. But for now, as one of the speakers wants to know, the role of cooperatives in addressing these value chains, in creating equity, and in fostering change. Do they have a role, and if so, what might it be? Anita, would you like to start?
Sure, I can start, and I'm sure then Tom can compliment me. So, you know, I think cooperatives are incredibly important. I think one of the main things that they do is they act as the organizer of a bunch of small farmers that then together collectively can have a lot more power and influence. You know, even sometimes it's a matter of being able to access large volumes of fertilizer or seeds at a discount, and it's just all well coordinated. The other thing is the buyers like working with cooperatives because they can make sure that they're going to, you know, pick up an amount of supply of production that it makes it worth them stopping by and doing that. So rather than have to coordinate with each and every individual farmer. The other thing, cooperatives tend to be great for facilitating new information out to farmers and from farmers out to end markets. So They're very, very important. I think what we see in reality is a wide range of how strong cooperatives are. Some are very, very well managed, and then they do a really excellent job for the farmers. And others are not so well managed. And what we've seen in terms of the access to finance is that the access to finance piece, they want to see that the cooperatives are well managed so they can really count on them to make sure that those that get access to the finance really merit that access. So oftentimes they're doing a large loan to the cooperative that then manages smaller loans, say, for inputs to those farmers. So they need to be able to trust that the cooperative can manage those risks of those individual farmers internally. So the quality of the cooperative and its governance structure is very important as well. But I think that overall cooperatives will continue to be very important going forward.
Super. And maybe, Tom, if you have a sense of their role and what we might do to address them appropriately or integrate them?
Yes, several things. I think that one of the things that I want to start with that and then segue into the cooperatives point is that a lot of times I've heard in development circles, as Daniele was emphasizing, I've spent 21 years in the field out of the 30, and so I've kind of heard a lot of people talking about things over time. And very, very often in donor circles and government circles and NGO circles, people are assuming that there is nothing going on, that basically you have to form a co-op or you have to invest in a hub, otherwise you have to build warehouses, otherwise these things are not going to get done. What I found in our work in the past 7 years in Africa and Asia is what you could describe as a quiet revolution, where there's been an immense rise of wholesale and logistics and warehouse services at the small and medium scale. These are not big corporations. And there's thousands of them, and I remember in a recent trip working in Myanmar, in Burma. And basically, we were there and there was a plan that was afoot to build value-added services and co-ops and warehouses at the village level. And we found that, in fact, there was a massive amount of these services already available at the township and city level that traders were engaged in and other actors and transporters in the system. So I would urge you to think about what wholesalers and logistics people are already doing with farmers that aggregate the product and try to work with that as much as possible and leverage that. Okay, so the second point about cooperatives per se is I would caution you about that. I think that it's extremely important to have aggregation services, either from wholesalers or cooperatives or both, because really cooperatives are basically wholesalers. Okay, they're basically acting as intermediaries with their producers, and I've seen a lot of failures. I mean, I think, in fact, you could say that the great majority don't work very well, and part of it is because it's very difficult to manage these things, and there's a very low incentive to get it right outside of where they're in a product that's usually a non-grain product that has a pretty high payoff. And the second danger that I've seen, but it's also an opportunity, is that a lot of times the cooperative efforts are not market-oriented. They're not really business-oriented, listening to what the market needs. And so they might start with an initial investment that's useful, but then not follow up flexibly with what the market is requiring and fall apart, especially once artificial support for them is withdrawn and they're on their own. Very often you see them fall apart. And so thinking about setting up these kinds of activities in such a way that they'll be listening to the market and investing flexibly in what the market's requiring as threshold investments is crucial. And the last point is really an illustration of that. In Brazil, over a 10-year period, there was a massive change in the milk market. The milk market expanded by almost 10 times. There was a lot of investment by Nestle and other large players that changed the nature of the market, increased the quality requirements, the safety requirements, but also massively expanded and diversified it. The government of Brazil came in to support and set up cooperatives and support the cooperatives with cooling tanks for milk. And what happened is that thousands of the cooperatives went out of business, and thousands of the small farmers exited the sector simply because the cooling tanks were just one component of a set of things that was necessary to do to keep the cooperatives competitive with respect vis-a-vis medium-sized farmers in the market, including organizational and safety practices and feeding practices, many things that came together as a package. So I think that keeping your eye on the investment, threshold investments necessary to stay in the market is a crucial point for the cooperative's subject.
Thanks, Tom. That's great. And I think that reflects some of the lessons learned by many of all of our colleagues, starting with Jim Bingen a few decades ago, one of your colleagues at MSU, and others that have worked with us to help get the diagnostics right. You do need that market orientation is just about everything with cooperatives. I would fully agree with your assessment of that. There are a lot of great questions, and I apologize to all of who are not getting them answered directly today, but really thank you for sending them along. If you have included your email with them, we'll certainly pass them along and try to make sure they get answered. Can't vouch for the speakers getting to all of them. They're all busy and traveling quite a bit, but we'll hopefully do that. But before we go, I'm going to ask each of our colleagues to take a minute and address this one overarching theme that someone asked, that given the realities of small farming, what's needed today, based on the lessons we've learned in the last few years, what are the top three things or so that we need to address for greater impact, to make a difference, to crack this particular nut, or at least begin cracking the nut, to use Anita's analogy?
Sure. Do you want, I can start first if you want. So, thanks, Danielle. I think that smallholders are going to continue to be very, very important. And so the fact that, you know, we've seen that smallholders, especially if they're not very well integrated into a supply chain, into have a clear end buyer, they really suffer from that access to information and access to finance. And so we need to figure out ways to bring more of them in cost effectively to these supply chains, or we're going to see the finance continuing to be scarce, and then they aren't able to invest in their farms to be able to provide the production to the quality standards that is demanded in these urban markets. So that's part of the cracking the nut concept, is we're still trying to figure out how do we get this finance to flow, you know, even down to that level, and it's a combination of things. And then part of one of the things that we'll be talking about, too, at the conference is the role of digital financial services. I do think they can be very important to help reduce the cost of, you know, access or the transaction costs to reach these rural areas, but it's not necessarily going to be the solution for making sure the finance flows to the smallholder, because there's more issues than just that issue. And so one of the things I think will be very interesting at the conference is we have three digital financial service providers that have been using different approaches to reduce risk associated with lending to smallholders that will be very interesting, that will hopefully find some additional ways that access to information can help to reduce risk and then therefore facilitate the flow of finance to smallholders. And I think that my final point is just kind of that given the coming pressures of, you know, population growth and climate change and food securities, governments, you know, are likely going to continue to get involved. And here the tricky part is really figuring out what is the best way to involve the government, what types of subsidies are actually smart subsidies, and how can we make sure that the ways that governments get involved are actually facilitative of the market and not damaging of the environment. So I agree that the comment on the information and knowledge and tools that can help facilitate this flow of information and knowing what to do with information is going to be very important in the future.
Thanks very much, Anita. I do apologize to everyone that we've just gone into the 11 o'clock. We're over time. I'm going to leave just a space for Tom. I know he'll say something useful to all of us, and we'll close with him. Tom, please.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yes, I have four quick points to end. The first one is just to reiterate that the urban markets in the countries and the non-grain products as well as the feed grain products, I hear some typing, I think, are extremely, extremely important opportunities, wonderful opportunities for small farmers. Secondly, I think that it's important to look at what those markets require and work backward, not so much taking a hammer and seeing where the nail is, but looking back from the market and asking, what do the farmers and other actors have to do to meet that demand? Number three, I would emphasize that the farmers on their own, alone, even with cooperatives, can do nothing to reach that market. They have to have a functioning supply chain, both of inputs and ag services coming to them, and the middle, which I call often the hidden middle, is so important, of the wholesaling, transport, and logistics, and warehouses, and cold chain. All of these are extremely important. If those don't work, you can do anything you want with the farm, and it won't work. It won't reach those markets. So that's crucial, supply chain. And the last point is, I think there are such important things that have to be done at the farm level. The farmers are orphans in the sense of the extension agents helping them to do this kind of non-grain work and meet the urban markets. And I think that, you know, emphasis on mechanization, on water, and including groundwater wells, feed, disease, all of these things are so important on the technology side. So urban markets and diversification, investment requirements focused on a whole supply chain perspective, and meeting these kinds of intensification and modernization needs for the small farmers are a package that I think will deliver real hope and real development to small farmers going forward. Thank you.
Fantastic. Wow. Anita, Tom, you are just amazing. I'm terribly grateful for your efforts and sharing your time with the folks who are gathered. I sense from all the questions that we got that we didn't get to that we probably should do this again before too long, but it has been a real pleasure. Thank you. And for those of you who would like access to this webinar, we'll be posting it on the COSA website, so you'll be able to download it and listen to it or share it if you like, and look forward to, on the next one, to hearing from more folks. Thank you very much, Tom. Thank you, Anita.
Thank you.
And thanks, Patrick, for managing this.
Thank you, Patrick.